You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, lawmakers in Guatemala are set to decide whether the country's president ought to be immune from corruption charges. But with much of his cabinet having already quit, will it lead to a further falling of what confidence in the government remains? My studio guests, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and James Boyes, will be here with their take. Then, what's in a name? Plenty, according to US President Barack Obama. He's declared that Mount McKinley will revert to its original name of Denali. But Ohio is not happy. Plus, tremendous news for anyone who thought that what the Republican presidential contest really needed was the intervention of Sarah Palin.
Everything about Donald Trump's campaign, it's avant-garde, and he is crushing it in the polls. One American News, you viewers, he's talking to you.
The former vice presidential hopeful, and yes, that was a thing that actually happened, interviewed Donald Trump on her cable news show. Comparisons with the Gore Vidal, William Buckley conversations have thus far been thin on the ground. And we'll look at a new television series dramatizing the gruesome life of a notorious, arguably the most notorious, drug lord.
We were witnessing the formation of the famed Medellin cartel. There was Jose Rodriguez Gacha, the Ochoa brothers, and last but not least, Pablo Escobar.
All coming up on Midori House live from Studio One with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University in London and author of What If Latin America Ruled the World, and James Boyes, historian and author of Clinton's Grand Strategy and the forthcoming Hillary Rising. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Guatemala City, where Parliament is due to vote tomorrow on whether or not to strip President Otto Perez Molina over immunity from prosecution so that he might face the music over his alleged involvement in a customs boondoggle. President Molina survived a similar vote earlier this month and, as is traditional in such circumstances, is denying everything. Large numbers of the population, as is also customary, are demonstrating heartily in favour of him pushing off. Oscar, first of all, for those listeners who may not have been keeping up with Guatemalan politics as they might have, the La Línea scandal, as it's known, what is he actually on the hook for here?
Well, La Línea was a, as you pointed out, a network of fraudsters who were helping businesses go around paying custom taxes. And quite a few high-ranking politicians in Guatemala have been linked. The vice president is actually in jail. And the president is now being accused because of, he was heard as being referred to by pseudonym and also by ranking some telephone conversations.
James, as a general principle, and I do urge people to read up on this more thoroughly because it is, we are in the realms of things you could not make up. As Oscar points out, the vice president is in the clink awaiting trial. More than a dozen ministers have resigned. It's a bit rich at this point of the president to be saying, no, I had absolutely no idea anything amiss might have been going astray. I'm entirely innocent of absolutely everything.
You're absolutely right. And just on the basic principle of the idea of the captain of the ship being responsible for what happens during his or her service, you know, the idea is he has to assume responsibility. How we can suggest that he has nothing to do with it at this point seems somewhat dubious. And as Oscar rightly pointed out, you know, when you've got the vice president who looks like, you know, she's going to be charged with taking $3.7 million worth of bribes, you know, that's serious money by anybody's estimate, quite frankly. So I think the odds are on for a shortened presidency in this case.
Oscar, are we in the realm here of, you know, it's one of those cases where there's no escape for President Molina, is there? Either he should have known, he didn't know, or he should have known. It's one of those things. If he knew, he's colluded with it, and if he didn't know, then he's an idiot.
Absolutely, but let's. I urge listeners to remember that we have quite a few cases these in Latin America of former presidents and/or presidents. The name comes to my mind of Álvaro Uribe Vélez in Colombia, who, you know, has 2/3 of his former cabinet are in jail, and he's still growing strong. The problem with this particular case, with the Guatemalan case, is that we're very close to elections. We're effectively 2 or 3 weeks from elections.
As soon as September 9th, some
exactly.
people are saying.
September 6th or September 9th.
Which is next week.
But also, it might be the case that the story is not just about the current president, but also about Manuel Valdizón, the candidate who is most likely to win the elections and who has been linked to drug dealing networks. It seems to be the case that what we're witnessing here is the possibility of either those elections being postponed or the creation of a context so that the possibility of Valdizón becoming president will be stopped.
James, U.S. foreign policy being a particular mm-hmm. specialty of yours, you would be more aware than most people that America's record in dealing with its neighbors in Central and South America has not been one of untrammeled success. Is there a role for Washington here, or is this one of those things that the U.S. can best help by keeping well out of it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the idea that the Yankee colossus to the north has done an awful lot of damage by going in there and trampling around in Guatemala in the past in particular. I don't think that the American presidential system necessarily has many great examples to show here. When you think about the fact that under President Nixon, for example, everybody, including the Attorney General, ended up going into prison for various crimes to do with Watergate, for example. So I think what is interesting here is the idea that you appear to have a system in Guatemala where by, you know, you have to lift the idea of someone being immune from prosecution. Whereas, at least in the United States, the idea is you do have the idea of even a president being equal under the eyes of the law, as Nixon and the topic of my research, President Clinton, found out to their cost.
I mean, Oscar, the demonstrations against him are obviously first and foremost about this preposterous circus of a government he's been running. But how much of it is still, I guess, a postponed demonstration against his role in the Civil War?
Well, I would like to think that such is the case. Having said that, yes, as you pointed out, he's infamous for having been linked at least on two occasions to genocides and massacres against Guatemalan indigenous peoples. But it seems to be the case that that's not enough of a crime these days. You have to link these guys to some sort of taking money. When money comes into play, then they're not left off the hook, hence the demonstration. But it has also been suggested that these demonstrations are coming a bit too late, and they're also missing the bigger picture, which, as I pointed out before, may have to do with what is likely to happen in the coming elections.
It's kind of interesting, though, isn't it? I mean, you're talking there about the financial element to this, and it brought to my mind that classic line, you know, follow the money. And the idea that there's so many crimes that politicians are guilty of that they'll never write down, in this case, to do with atrocities against their own people, which they have plausible deniability. But as soon as you bring money into it, there's a cash flow, there are ledgers to look at. I mean, think about Al Capone, and what he was brought down for was tax evasion. And again, with Watergate, it was all about following the money, because then you could tie individuals up to individual bank accounts, etc.
It also says a lot about our moral sense.
Oh, yes.
It's no longer connected with the things that we should be outraged for, but rather money.
Okay, well, we will have further time this week to discuss this after Parliament votes in Guatemala City tomorrow. But let's look now at the US, where one of its two assassinated presidents, who nobody can ever remember at pub quizzes, is about to lose his most dramatic monument. Garfield is the other one, if people are already annoying themselves. North America's highest peak, Mount McKinley in Alaska, will henceforth be officially known by its native Athabascan name, Denali. Cue predictable fury from representatives of McKinley's home state of Ohio and from the growing numbers of Americans employed in the country's burgeoning outrage industry. Oscar, Alaska's been campaigning for this for years. Is this really a problem?
It shouldn't be a problem. Even a Republican senator in Alaska thought this was a good idea. She had, in fact, tried to pass a bill to do this. But here... we may want to invoke Cornel West's distinction between a symbol and substance. This is a symbolic victory, and we have seen Barack Obama achieving quite a few of this in his last months in the office. But less so in terms of the substance. American indigenous peoples have, as history puts it, been the banishing character in American politics. Much more needs to be done in order to readdress that balance.
difference.
But just to follow that up, Oscar, how much difference or how important do you think symbolic gestures like that can be? Because thinking as an Australian, it puts me in mind of... since 1993, Ayers Rock, which rather preposterously was named, I think I'm right in saying, after the then governor of South Australia after it was founded by white people, has been officially dual named since 1993. But most Australians now refer to it by its Aboriginal name of Uluru.
That's precisely the point of West's distinction between symbol and substance. In symbolic terms, this might matter, but not that much. Yes, McKinley never even set foot in Alaska, so it's preposterous that the man mountain has his name. But what is needed is substance, and that's what has been lacking both in the Obama administration, but also in politics historically regarding Indigenous peoples as such.
James, how much upset and fury and fear and loathing do you think this is actually causing in the bars and saloons of Ohio?
Well, one of the problems you've got is that the road to the White House now goes through Ohio. So if you don't
Indeed
win Ohio,
so.
It's a major problem.
Eight presidents from Ohio as well.
There you go. If Hillary wants to become president, if Joe Biden wants to be president, they need to win Ohio. One of the great challenges at the moment is obviously John Kasich is campaigning for the Republican nomination. No one expects him to get the nomination, but if he was made vice president, for example, that would make Ohio that much more difficult to win for a Democratic administration in waiting, effectively. Obama hasn't done, arguably, any Democrats any favours by doing this. He can do it, of course, because he's not running for re-election, so what does he care?
Could have named it after himself.
He could have done, actually. What is fascinating, I was reading this this morning, and I was actually reminded about something similar that happened in the aftermath of the Kennedy administration's Kennedy's assassination, in which Lyndon Johnson asked, basically, what can I do for you, Jackie Kennedy? And she said, name the spaceport after my husband. So the Kennedy Space Center becomes the JFK Center out of Florida. But Johnson went one step beyond and named the whole of Cape Canaveral after Cape Kennedy. So for a while in the 1960s, Cape Canaveral becomes Cape Kennedy. And that obviously was reverted later on in terms of, you know, a knee-jerk reaction to an assassination.
New York's International Airport lost its beautiful name of Idlewild as well.
There you are. I don't think that necessarily too many people are lamenting the reversion to JFK International Airport, but certainly there were many people who felt that the naming of the entire Cape down in Florida was a step too much, and that reverted back to its original name in the end. So here we are now, another American president's assassinated name being taken off a natural area in the United States.
But just to follow that up, James, hasn't Ohio got a whole state full of stuff they could name after him if they're really that upset?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it that if you want to do that, you can very much do so. What I would say, though, is that if you go around the United States, Republicans will say that there are a great many more things named after Democrats than there are after Republicans. And it's one of the reasons that there was a great push to get Ronald Reagan's name, for example, put on National Airport in Washington, D.C., because there was a feeling that American heroes had tended to come from the left and not from the right. And I guess this is you could say, if you wanted to take that approach, that McKinley was a Republican president whose name has been taken off something by a Democrat.
I did look this up, trying to find things actually named after William McKinley apart from the mountain. Deliciously, three fictional high schools are named after William McKinley. Fictional high schools in television series. Three of them. Glee, Freaks and Geeks, and The Wonder Years.
There we are.
William McKinley High School. All of them.
Only in fiction.
Well, this is one of the years politics, perhaps.
I think it's a glorious fact. I like that. Oscar, to return to your earlier point, is there something that makes... Because, again, Australia occasionally finds itself in a similar dilemma. There's a push to, for example, I know, to rename Fraser Island in Queensland, Kigari, which is the local Aboriginal language name for it. Is there something, do you think, I might be trying a bit hard here, but in settler societies, which is essentially what Australia and the United States are, does it make people a bit nervous, the idea of returning things to the names that they were given by the people from whom the land was taken?
Of course, because it reminds them of their original sin. That's the point. Credit to Obama, he has taken a few measures to re-engage the American Native community of Alaska into politics. But it pales in comparison to what has happened both in South America and in Canada, where Native Americans are making a comeback. Again, these at the symbolic level, this reminds us that they are there and that they are making a comeback. And it reminds us of the original sin at the basis of our civilization. But much more needs to be done.
A final thought on this, James. Do you think it is important in that respect that if you have now generations of, you know, American school kids being told that the highest mountain in our country is named Denali, and then are therefore having to ask, why is it called Denali? What sort of a name is Denali? What language does that come from? Etc.
I'm reminded of your original point about Ayers Rock, which is that with respect, its name may have changed as long ago as you saw, you pointed out. I don't know anybody in this country who could tell you its original name is not Ayers Rock anymore. So I wonder whether in the United States, if textbooks are being used, which are not updated, for example, which is not unusual, whether the idea that the name Mount McKinley might still stick, even though Obama has changed. As we come back to Oscar's point about substance and style, et cetera, whether this will have a lasting impact or whether there will be a movement within the United States to say, well, fair enough, President Obama can do what he wants. We're going to keep referring to it by its old name.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Oscar Guardiola Rivera and James Boyce. Coming up next, Netflix's new flagship series is a sort of Breaking Bad for real, and the vice president who mercifully never was meets the president who mercifully never will be.
Our ideas-packed Entrepreneur's Guide, the design directory for people who want to build a better home. The style guide for getting to grips with the business of looking good. The soft power survey. The travel top 50. Monocle magazine has a superlative lineup of survey reports and investigations coming your way. And to make sure that you never miss an issue, you just need to do one thing. Become a Monocle subscriber. Not only will you get all of this great journalism, you'll also have free access to our full archive of stories online, receive invites to subscriber events around the world, and be sent a free gift too. Go to monocle.com/subscribe to join us today.
And you are welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Oscar Guardiola and James Boyce. Now, if you've enjoyed Breaking Bad or other televisual chronicles of organised criminals, you might also enjoy this.
Imagine you were born in a poor family, in a poor country. And by the time you were 28 years old, you have so much money you can't even count it.
Señores, yo soy Pablo Emilio Escobar Gaviria.
Haciendo negocios, así que pues fresco.
Ustedes eligen plata o plomo.
But I don't want to get ahead of myself.
A clip from Narcos, Netflix's new series chronicling the life and crimes of Pablo Escobar. Escobar was, of course, the Colombian cocaine baron who, by the time of his unlamented demise in a Butch and Sundance scenario with police in Medellin in 1993, was reckoned to be the richest criminal who had ever lived. Oscar, there are 10 episodes on Netflix, of which reviews so far have been pretty good. You've seen one of them, I believe.
Yes, I did today.
What did you make of it?
It's not Breaking Bad at all, but it's interesting as entertainment.
How is it likely to play among Colombians? Is it because it does humanize the man? It portrays him as a relatively three-dimensional person with a family life, etc., not just this kind of cartoon monster. Is that something people are ready to see at this point?
Well, by now there have been three or four soap operas made in Colombia, one of them about Pablo Escobar, and at least one of them was not too terrible. So I don't think this will be incredibly surprising, although I guess the reaction from, the good thinking Colombians will be, bare-chesting, pumping on how dare they, stain our name once more. But he is a crucial part of our contemporary history. What bothers me about these TV series is that they always stop short of dealing with the real issue, which is the convergence between drugs, drugs money in particular, and politics. They always stop short.
Yes, funny that. James, some of the reviews have also suggested that the series does at least reflect what is not, to return to your specialist subject of American foreign policy, far from a glorious chapter. The CIA tend to look as sort of actually, possibly actively venal, whereas the DEA are portrayed as, well-meaning but somewhat inept. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that anybody looks back at this time period and thinks it's a particularly proud moment in US foreign policy within that part of the world. One of the things I was struck by with regards to this series is the way in which you've seen an evolution in how the media address its the stars of these programs. You know, you go back, a decade or two, and you would focus upon, this program would have focused upon the hero of this, like the DEA examples, the CI guys, who were the heroes in this and bringing them down. Then you go through an era whereby, oh, that's not good enough, you can't do that, you have to take an everyman approach to history, for example. So when the Cuban Missile Crisis was originally dramatized in the 1970s, for example, when Martin Sheen was playing Robert Kennedy in the Missiles of October, it looked at the Kennedy brothers as heroes. Then you move into the late 90s and 2000s, and you take an everyman approach. So you look at it through Kevin Costner with the worst Boston accent ever put on film, effectively, with the 13 Days escapade, and it's an everyman approach. Now you've gone the full flip, and in sort of following the idea of the Sopranos approach, effectively. Now it's the anti-hero as hero, effectively, and we're looking at this through the eyes of, you know, the nemesis, as it should be in this program. So it'll be interesting to see how it is that Escobar's heroic stature, if that's what it becomes, emerges out of this. Because as soon as you put full eyes and attention upon someone who's evil, I mean, we saw this with Tony Soprano, you know, Jimmy Gandolfini becomes a sex object. You know, he was a fat New York actor, effectively, playing a criminal, but because you put a light upon someone who is notoriously bad, all of a sudden they assume a new life and a role of their own.
And almost everybody's favourite characters in The Wire were the drug dealers as well. Oscar, how does a film, I think anything you make for television or cinema that deals with organised criminals, you have to decide whether you're going to sort of rebel against the Scorsese clichés or embrace them. Which of the two does it choose?
That's a difficult one. But most likely they will go for the Al Pacino, the Scarface cliché. Having said that, I'm really looking forward to the last chapter. I want to see if the historical fact that the other cartel actually helped the DEA to get Escobar is going to be portrayed here.
Okay, well, that's 10 episodes of Narcos available now on Netflix. Finally tonight, and we do have some audio, which I know everybody's looking forward to, we should look at Sarah Palin's interview of Donald Trump, in which the ridiculous, bloviating populist simpleton with stupid hair, who no sane party would have allowed within 1,000 miles of a presidential ticket, spoke to the former governor of Alaska.
They're pretty gracious when it comes to then treating the press the way that sometimes they're not going to treat us conservatives, speaking of the press. So you get hit with these gotchas like most conservatives do. For instance, they asking, what's your favorite Bible verse? And I'm listening to that going, what? Do they ask Hillary that? What does it have to do with running for the office of the presidency? Is it anybody's business? These personal gotcha questions really trying to get you, us, anybody running for office off game. How are you finding that and finding a technique to put them in their place so that the American public isn't wasting their time and they actually get to hear what's important via a candidate's message?
Well, you saw that. You know, I love the Bible, and I'm a Protestant, I'm Presbyterian, and they were hitting me with different questions one after another. And, look, I don't know if it's got you, but probably is.
One of those people could have been an old man's heartbeat away from launch codes. Another of them actually wants access to them. This meeting of minds occurred on Palin's show on cable network One American News, which is a sort of Fox News for people who find Bill O'Reilly confusingly nuanced. James, why would Sarah Palin have lowered herself to this?
Ratings. Plus the idea that, you know, I'm sure she still hankers after being vice president, quite frankly. We were talking about Alaskan politics earlier on. You know, Alaska solidly votes Republican in the presidential election. Sarah Palin, you know, still hankers after the top job, I'm sure. She's managed to convince herself that she deserves it. And to be fair, you know, if you have run as the vice presidential candidate in the past, you know, I dread to say it, there are a number of Americans who would still like to see her on the ticket. It's not impossible that if Trump was to get the nomination, heaven forbid.
Out loud, James.
It's not impossible. The biggest risk here is not necessarily him winning the Republican nomination. It's him getting to a point where his ego gets to a point where it's like, hey, you know what, I don't need the Republicans. I run on my own. I bring in who I want. And you'd have to say that Sarah Palin might well be someone who might well be on his ticket if he was to run as an independent.
God, the real danger. That's the real danger.
The dream team.
Yeah, Trump becomes president and Palin is vice president.
It ain't an impossibility.
Oscar, who are the people watching this exchange and thinking, yep, neither of this pair is a complete simpleton?
Those who consider Gore Vidal way too high. I'm thinking if Barack Obama didn't change the name of Mount McKinley just to piss off Palin.
It would be an excellent reason to do anything. James, the transcript and full video of this encounter is worth watching for anybody who can stand it. But I was struck by one particular claim of Donald Trump, who just boldly announced that 93 million Americans are out of work. That's just not true. But has Trump finally discovered what may be the golden egg of modern politics, that you can just make stuff up, nobody cares?
Yeah, pretty much. You can pluck numbers out of thin air, throw them around. There is so much media coverage nowadays that there really isn't an awful lot of time to stop and think and say, hang about, did any of that make any sense whatsoever? Clearly, with regard to any figures...
Because he's not even bothering to take things out of context.
No, he's
just making it up.
No, and if you think about his statements, they're so simple. It's like, I'd be great at this, and, you know, African-Americans love me, and Mexicans love me. No one is challenging him in any of this, and it's just unbelievably simplistic. And, you know, the idea that these people are competing for the most important elected office in the world still is quite frankly ridiculous. You know, he's turning the American presidency into a game show. You know, there was a movie about this a couple of years ago. His name escapes me. And it was literally, you know, pick a president based upon a sort of an X Factor approach. Well, you know, we've gotten to that point almost in reality now.
Oscar, why does the Republican Party in particular seem to have a difficulty, certainly in modern times, of keeping fruitcakes out of its presidential contests?
Well, because they are also very bad at keeping fruitcakes out of their grassroots movements. You know, there is a link in between those two things. Palin was referring directly to Trump's ill treatment of Jorge Ramos.
You were actually able to figure out what Palin was referring to.
She does mention... she does mention Ramos after the gotcha bit. And of course, when one compares this interview with the way in which Jorge Ramos did challenge Donald Trump, one can see the two possibilities here. One is, using the media to persuade us that truth doesn't matter anymore when it comes to power. The other one, to speak truth to power.
See, James, I don't think Donald Trump is actually going to get the nomination.
No, okay.
Therefore, I don't think he's going to be president. But he's clearly understands something about how the modern media, and especially about how modern social media works, and how it gives a voice to people who, frankly, in bygone times might not have had one for perfectly good reasons. If it's not Trump, how great, seriously, is the danger that within, say, four or five presidential elections from now, some absolute yahoo might actually get elected president of the United States?
I think you're being generous. You think about 4 to 5 cycles, that's what, 25, 30 years. I mean, the way Trump's going. The only thing I would say is that the parallel historically with Trump that I'd want people to think about is with Ross Perot. Ross Perot was another crazed billionaire, too much time on his hands and too much money, and he ran as an independent because he couldn't get the Republican nomination if he tried, quite frankly, and all he'll do is he'll split the vote on the right. So for those who are scared about the idea of a Trump presidency, the idea here is actually what he's doing is actually potentially helping any Democrat, potentially therefore Hillary Clinton, become president, just as it helped her husband in 1992.
Oscar, what do you think? Might Trump be the kind of... Might he be peak Yahoo? Might there be a backlash against it? Or could someone of his stature actually become president one day?
Well, there is a backlash against him, particularly among Latinos, of course.
I don't think there was ever a frontlash, in fairness.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. We won't have to wait too long to see somebody like this rising. We need to rethink the role of the media vis-a-vis power.
There is an H.L. Mencken quote in closing, which I know I'm paraphrasing badly, but it is something to the effect that one day the American peoples will have their heart's greatest wish answered and that the White House will be adorned by an outright moron. It goes something like that. On that happy note, we will have to leave it. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, James Boyes, thank you for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's episode of Midori House, which was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Federica Romaniello and Paige Reynolds. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. Daniel Giacopelli is up next with Monocle's International Playlist. Robert Bound is in at 1900 with Culture. At 2200, it's the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 London. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.